Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Today, wine writer and novelist Jay McInerney talks the wine characters he's come to love, like the Oedipus at Hermitage, the Ghetto Boys, and the man Jay says gave us the liveliest and most pungent wine writing of the 20th century. That woman who makes baking sound so doable, Dory Greenspan, gives her masterclass in cookies. We go to Bali, where farmers sleep under their vanilla plants to guard them from thieves, and an ancient spice trade is struggling with the 21st century. Then it's grass-fed beef. New York Times columnist Marion Burroughs has been tasting and making some interesting discoveries. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column for Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, you know, many states claim to be the place where the very best hamburgers are made. I mean, Connecticut claims to be the original place of the hamburger. Texas has some fabulous hamburgers. Kansas has terrific hamburgers. But I have to say, I think the most hamburger-conscious state in the nation, and the place where you get the best and most interesting hamburgers in the best and most interesting restaurants, is Oklahoma.
What?
In particular,
I never would have thought of Oklahoma as hamburger country. I don't know why, but...
Yeah. If you travel through it, sooner or later you realize that it is. I mean, there are different parts of the state where they make hamburgers in unique ways. I mean, I think we've actually talked about the onion fried burgers on Route 66 just west of Oklahoma City.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, but even just regular hamburgers, places take great care in making them. And the other thing that's so great about them is these hamburger places are the kind of hamburger joint that you don't find too much anymore. I'm talking, for example, about Hamburger King in Shawnee, Oklahoma. This place opened in 1927, and it really hasn't changed all that much. I mean, the prices have gone up from 10 cents to $3.05 for a hamburger.
Yeah, well.
But the place itself still has that old kind of Oklahoma country flavor about it.
It's just really an old lunchroom. I mean, it looks like it goes back to the 1920s. But probably aside from the fabulous hamburgers, I am just so in love with the way you order the hamburger.
How do you order?
Which is you're sitting at your booth or your table and there's an old telephone on it and you pick it up and the kitchen answers and you place your order. But I mean, you're like, you know, 5 feet away from the kitchen.
But you have to dial them on the phone.
It's like making a long distance call, you know, in the 1950s where you're like shrieking at the top of your lungs, you know, because this is such an exciting thing. Also, if you really are a hamburger loather, which I can imagine who would be, they do make a darn good catfish dinner there. And they also make Frito pie, which is one of the great lost meals of America. You know, it's chili beef on a split open little package of Fritos.
Right.
But let me just say that wonderful as the food is at this place and the kind of old hamburger joint ambiance, what really got to us was the decor, because on the back wall is a picture that it's huge. It's almost a life-size photograph of music star Bob Wills and movie star Jack Hoxie from, the 1930s, standing on either side of the proprietor, a guy named George Maxis, who opened the place in 1927, who was then known as Oklahoma's Hamburger King. And in fact, next to that photo is a song, are the words of a song that Bob Wills actually once wrote to honor his favorite burger shop. Now, I can't sing it, but can I tell you a few lines from it?
Sure, sure.
It goes like this. It says, "When you're feeling blue and hungry too, here's a tip to make you sing. Pick up your hat, close up your flat, and go down to Hamburger King."
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye.
All sun, St. Lucas, see you now. All good. Old Aunt Dinah, dead and gone. Out of here, not as long as you're gone. All night.
Chain and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you know, you can get their food finds anytime. The website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our newsletters. We have two for you now. There's the classic Weeknight Kitchen, and for a limited time, Baker's Chronicle. It's a weekly e-newsletter devoted to bakers and baker wannabes. Now, every week you get a new recipe, and of course, both of them are free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Dory Greenspan is the home baker's baker. Now, she's written books with pastry pros on both sides of the Atlantic, but it's Dory's genius that's literally brought their recipes home to us. And that's why I wanted Dory to initiate our masterclass series. Now, in each session, a master of the craft is going to lead us step by step through the logic of a great dish. Well, today, it's Dory Greenspan with a master cookie class. Dory's new book is Baking From My Home to Yours. Hey, Dory, welcome back.
So happy to be back again. And talking about something I love, cookies.
Well, exactly. And I thought, you know, people look at the cookie. They don't think of this as, you know, something to do a master class on. But this is an important thing.
Well, I think cookies are important, and I've given them a lot of thought. And, you know, it's funny because the holidays are coming up, and people who haven't even opened their oven, or people like my mother who use their oven for a bread box, are going to be baking cookies. I mean, it's the most popular thing to bake. So I have some tips and some hints and some rules, the things I feel really strongly about, that I'd like to pass along.
Could we start with the rules, then?
Well, the rule, it's actually for cookies, and it's for all baking or cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Don't start before you read the recipe all the way through. Okay, there's nothing worse than being in the middle of mixing something up and finding out you're, you know, short of eggs.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Okay, another rule, and again, it's good for both cooking and baking, is have your ingredients measured out and ready to go. Pretend you're on the Food Network. Okay, this is your stage. Once you get set up, it makes it so much easier. Make sure your oven is preheated. When you finish, you know, putting your little cookies on the sheet, they need to go into an oven that's at temperature. So you really need to like the Boy Scouts, be prepared. When you're baking cookies, choose a baking sheet that's really sturdy, something that you can't twist and turn with your own little hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that you should avoid insulated baking sheets for cookies.
Why?
Because your cookies will never burn on an insulated sheet. But you know what? They're not going to brown and bake through nicely either. There just
isn't
enough underheat.
So they throw off the process.
Right. So you want to have a regular baking sheet, a cookie sheet. And because I'm a lazy baker, I think you should line your sheets either with parchment or with those nifty silicone baking mats. It helps the cookies to bake more evenly, and it also makes cleanup a cinch.
Yeah, because you don't grease the pan or do anything like
exactly.
that.
Exactly, right? And so you don't have to wash off all that grease. And then when I'm jumping just ahead to when the cookies are going on this beautifully lined sheet, give your cookies some spread space. Most recipes will tell you, you know, leave an inch between each cookie mound or 2 inches, but you want to leave room for the cookies to spread, and you also want to leave that room so that the heat can circulate around the cookies.
Mm-hmm.
Cool the baking sheets between each batch.
That's so logical, but you don't do it. You're in a hurry.
You're in a hurry.
Yeah.
You're in a hurry. You've got, you know, you're going to be making 4 or 5 batches of cookies, and you just want to get them in and out. But you know what? Your cookies start baking on a hot cookie sheet, and they spread. You won't get the cookies you want. So cool them off between each batch.
Okay.
So those are pretty much the general rules. Now, when the recipe calls for beating the butter and sugar together, mm-hmm. as most recipes do, give the ingredients a good beating. You want the sugar to be really mixed into the butter very well. And then if the cookie dough recipe has eggs, it's probably the next step. It'll tell you to beat the eggs in one at a time and to probably beat for a minute after each egg goes in. Don't overdo it. Eggs are great for building volume in something that you're baking. And with most cookies, you don't really want to beat the eggs up so that they get a lot of air into them so that they puff in the oven, because often what will happen is, because cookies only bake for a short time, they'll puff in the oven and they'll flatten when they come out.
Huh.
So don't go crazy unless the recipe says beep, 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 beep.
Right, right.
Don't beat the eggs too much. And then, and this is true for all things that you're going to bake, whether it's cookies or cakes, use a really light hand when you're mixing in the dry ingredients. This is a time when less is more. And just stir until the flour disappears into the dough. Then stop. Okay, so now your dough is all mixed up, your oven is preheated, your cookie sheet is all lined, your dough's mixed. Now, if you're making drop cookies, like great chocolate chip cookies or molded cookies, try to use the same amount of dough for each cookie. This will help the cookies bake evenly, and take it from one who knows, it'll also avoid fights. She got a bigger cookie than I got.
I hadn't thought about that part of it, but you're right.
So, and if you're making bar cookies or brownies, and I love making bar cookies for the holidays because you make one batch and you get lots and lots and lots of cookies out of them. A good thing to do is to line the pan with foil. I'm liking the new nonstick aluminum foil. So line the pan with foil. Leave some foil at the edge that you can use for handles. And so this will help you lift the brownies out of the pan, and it'll save your pan from cutting within it, you know, so that you don't get scratches in the pan.
That's a great idea. And then you can also wrap and store if you want
exactly.
to. Exactly. Thank you, dear.
It's been fun. Happy cookie making.
You too. Dory Greenspan's new book is a keeper. It's called Baking From My Home to Yours. Now, Dory solved the holiday cookie quandary of what to bake with not one, but three recipes. The great chocolate world peace cookies, grandma's all-occasion sugar cookies, and these little light nut meringues called Cafe Volcano cookies. And they're all on the website. splendidtable.org. Now, you can get to us another way and meet like minds along the way. It's simple. Join our food talk group on gather.com. It's an online space to ask questions and trade recipes. Head to splendidtable.org and click on food talk. Coming up, wine critic Jay McInerney on the Oedipus of Hermitage and the last word on grass-fed beef from New York Times' Marion Burroughs. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Well, if you ever thought wine writing was pretty dull, you need to take a look at Jay McInerney's wine columns in House & Garden magazine. Jay knows his stuff, but I like the mischief in his soul. I like how provocative he can be and how he drives home the point that wine is made by people who have points of view, obsessions, and foibles. Well, Jay's new book is an idiosyncratic collection of essays and portraits. It's called A Hedonist in the Wine Cellar, Adventures in Wine. Jay, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Lynn. Great to be back.
Yeah, with all these years of, even before you started wine writing, you were mixing it up with winemakers, wine people. Who stands out? The great personalities.
Well, it's a tough question because, you know, there are so many great personalities in the world of wine. You know, you don't meet many anal retentive personalities. people in wine tend to be gregarious and flamboyant and dramatic. I will just kind of randomly reach out and say that somebody who just occurs to me near the top of the list is Michel Chapoutier, who is the owner of a domain in the Rhone Valley of France. He's based in Hermitage.
Yeah, that's one of the golden oldies. I mean, the Chapoutier label's been around forever.
Well, the label has been around for quite a while, but frankly, it was almost moribund when young Michel, who I guess is the fourth generation, came around. He joined his father and his brother in the winemaking operation at a time when its reputation had really suffered, and it was considered really a third-rate winery when Michel joined in, I believe, in 89. And he basically fired his father and his brother from the operation. In fact, you're not supposed to say these things when you're writing about wine, but he speaks with great venom about his father, and this really was quite a drama. And all I can say is that the results speak for themselves. This guy is driven. I'm telling you, he limps faster than I jog, and the reason that he limps is because he was so busy and obsessed with his winery. He fell and broke his leg in the vineyard, and he didn't go to the doctor for 2 months. He was just hobbling around on a leg that was broken in 4 places, and he simply did not feel that he had the time to go to the doctor. And he has such a powerful will that he somehow managed to get around on this incredibly broken and mangled leg. So, this is, this guy goes near the top of my list of wine obsessives. He's a passionate one.
Does the wine reflect it? Does the personality of the maker get into the wine?
It's a really good question. And in his case, I must say, these are really, his best wines are really big and powerful. And, they can arouse strong emotions. He makes a wonderful red and white Hermitage from this beautiful hill along the Rhone River that's been a source of great wine for hundreds and hundreds of years. His are certainly among the best. Huh. And they are very, they're very extreme wines. I guess they do reflect the personality.
What about the States?
Well, again, a lot of choices. But I'll tell you, I've just gotten very interested in the last few years in the Santa Barbara region. And the two guys who got me interested in this region, they make a wine called Brewer Clifton. Steve Clifton and Greg Brewer are a couple of guys who met when they were working for other wineries. And this is actually a fairly typical Santa Barbara story. People, they start working for big wineries, and then they sort of max out their credit cards to start their own wineries. the way that people used to do with indie films in the early 90s.
Yeah.
But what's fun about these guys is that, I talk about wines reflecting personalities. Greg was a French professor at Santa Barbara University, I believe. And Steve was in a rock and roll band, actually a very successful rock and roll band, and was a surfer before that. And I am telling you this, that, the best way to describe these wines is it's like they speak French, but they know how to shake it on the dance floor. These are very, they make Chardonnay and they make Pinot Noir, which are the two classic grapes of France's Burgundy region. And these guys, everybody who makes these wines in the States or anywhere else is always sort of aiming at Burgundy. And on the other hand, as I say, there's this rock and roll element that you don't, this sort of real power and fruit and it has to be said, alcohol as well. Burgundy, they struggle to just get the grapes ripe. And Santa Barbara is much more blessed by nature. And I just can't help thinking that this wine does reflect the personality of these two guys. Steve, in my experience, likes to, stay up and have a good time and go to bed about the same time that Greg is waking up. Basically it's kind of, Apollo and Dionysus. And I think it's reflected in wines. They just have this incredible balance.
Who else?
Well, I'll tell you, I started this 10 years ago, that is writing about wine. And on the one hand, I was really daunted because I didn't feel that I knew enough about wine. I was just, I was very passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd never taken a wine course. I'd never really visited wine country. I'd never in my life had I spit a wine out of my mouth, which is, proper tasting etiquette. It still seems a little weird to me. But as somebody who reads a lot of wine writing, I've got to say, there's a lot of it that is not very interesting. On the one hand, you have the flowery sort of tech. You have the horticultural approach.
Yes.
Bouquet of American Beauty Rose. you know, and I don't know anything about flour, so that leaves me cold. And on the other hand, you have the, you know, the really technical writing about malolactic fermentation and volatile acidity. Again, I know nothing about these things. So I just felt there had to be a way to write about wine that makes it interesting. And there actually was a role model out there, and his name is Oberon Waugh. He wrote about many things. He was the son of the novelist Evelyn Waugh. And he wrote about politics and literature. He was a very fierce writer. And actually, I have a little quote here. He says, "Wine writing should be camped up. The writer should never like a wine. He should be in love with it. Never find a wine disappointing, but identify it as a mortal enemy, an attempt to poison him. Bizarre and improbable side tastes should be proclaimed. Mushrooms, rotting wood, black treacle, burnt pencils, condensed milk, sewage." Well, this is how Braun, as everyone called him, wrote about wine. And I have to say that, you know, he's kind of my role model. Although I also have to say I'm more of a lover than a fighter.
Now, I gather he was British.
Yes.
Right.
He certainly was. I met him in the mid-80s. And in fact, I had many bottles of wine with him over the succeeding years. And Waugh, who was so incredibly articulate and usually savage in writing about wine, would say, "Oh, yes, looks red, yes, very nice, tasty," you know? I mean, he was so vague about, and in person, he was so vague about his host's wine, you know, always, you know, just sort of vaguely complimentary. Savage in print, though. And again, you know, a man full of passion. And I like people who have great passion for the grape. There's a couple of people whom I won't name. You know, we go to a big wine dinner at the end of the night. Their glasses are full. They've had little teensy-weensy sips of all the wine, and these are the ones I don't trust. I can't begin to trust the judgment of somebody who doesn't love wine.
Jay McInerney, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Novelist and wine writer Jay McInerney writes for House and Garden magazine. His book is A Hedonist in the Wine Cellar, Adventures in Wine. You know, there are places in the world that fire up images in your head. You don't even have to know where they are. Just their names are going to turn you on. Bali is like that. I think dancers in golden headpieces and spices. Spices that built European empires. Spices that people killed to get. Spices that made Bali rich and mysterious for half a millennium. Maria Bacalapolo reports from the island.
When a Hindu Balinese dies, their flesh is surrounded by a bounty of scented offerings. Jasmine in the nose to assure fragrant air, tamarind in the ears, and other aromatic spices for the spirit's hopefully auspicious reincarnation. With the air full of incense and music, the spirit leaves the body behind and begins its journey to heaven. Bali is one of the more than 18,000 soil-rich islands in the Indonesian archipelago. At the high cost of war and bloodshed, spices have long been fought over in the East Indies. Four centuries ago, nutmeg was worth its weight in gold in Europe, where physicians touted it as a panacea capable of curing plague, impotency, and even depression. In the lush green mountainous regions of northern Bali, vanilla, coffee, and cloves grow in bounty. 55-year-old Made Pintu is a farmer and has seen the fluctuations of trading spices in Bali over the years.
The climate is right here in the mountains, so you can plant anything here and it grows. We can still get a good price when we sell vanilla. So, of course, it is a big priority for us. But over the years, we've been having a problem with disease killing the plants, like many farmers in Bali.
Vanilla was the most lucrative crop in Bali up until the 1990s, when countries like Madagascar started to produce a better bean. Made's nephew, Ketut Simarti, tends to the crops every day. He believes the farmers in Bali were pushed out by competition because of reasons beyond their control.
We need the money. The spice traders that sold our vanilla for export put a lot of pressure on us to cut the vanilla early, before it was ready. What else could we do? Also, because we are afraid someone will steal the vanilla from our fields. We have to sleep next to the vanilla at night to guard it. So we sell it quickly to the trader because they will buy the vanilla young.
Today, vanilla and other spices are sold locally in the island's main market in Denpasar. Local trader 28-year-old Agus Suriano has taken over the family business of buying and selling spices here locally. Originally from India, Agus's father bought a space in this bustling local market back in the 1960s. Agus knew he was destined to take over the business as his father aged. Agus relies on tourists and the local Balinese.
The locals use many spices from my shop. For the Hindu ceremony like Ngaben or cremation, not only for cooking. There are more than 100 different kinds of spices used in some way in Balinese ceremonies, along with for food and medicine.
It is estimated that over 90% of Bali's vanilla exports end up in the U.S. French-born Françoise and Olivier Bernard started up the Tripper Group 12 years ago. Since then, this multi-million dollar American company has moved into the modern-day spice industry, selling cinnamon, vanilla, and nutmeg to large U.S. companies such as Kellogg's and Krispy Kreme Donuts. Their major product out of Indonesia now, though, is cinnamon. Olivier Bernard explains how history put Indonesia at the lead of cinnamon exports.
Little jump back in history. In the 60s, most American companies, mainly bakeries, were buying Vietnamese cinnamon. And then when the Vietnam War started, there was this main problem, embargo. So the American companies started looking at another origin, and which was Indonesia. Indonesia, the reason why we were very interested in cinnamon, it's because Indonesia is the number one producing country in the world for cinnamon. About 90 to 95% of the world cinnamon is grown in Indonesia. The second reason, it's that prices have been depreciated for many, many years, and we felt that if we could jump into a market where prices were, you could say, rock bottom, prices would go up. And I think things are starting to happen and prices are coming up, so I think it was a good move to go into cinnamon.
In Tripper Group's main offices in Bali, it's all about modernizing the spice trade in this internet communication age. Françoise Bernard.
Technology for us, I mean, for me especially, is the number one thing in our business. I think because of that, we can approach like different type of markets and be much more competitive than other people.
As other countries move quickly to dominate the world spice industry, Indonesia tries to regain the place it once held in history as the Spice Islands.
Maria Bakalapalo is a producer and journalist based in Indonesia.
Ecological types and health-conscious types are touting grass-fed beef as the next big thing. Now, most of our cattle spend their last 4 to 6 months being stuffed with grain. Supposedly, grass-fed is healthier and ecologically sounder. Now, the only problem with grass-fed beef has been the meat. Some think that perhaps it's a tad chewy and a little tasteless. Well, New York Times columnist Marion Burrows has taken a fresh look at grass-fed. Marion, welcome.
It's very nice to be with you again.
Now, you did a taste test, right?
Yes.
How many samples did you try?
Oh, wow. We tried so many over a long period of time, but I think in the end we tried at least 30.
So is this tasteless and chewy?
It depends. Some of them haven't quite figured out how to do it yet. Some of them have gotten a long way there, and some of them are all the way there. They are absolutely delicious, and you would never look at a grain-fed animal again.
So, Marion, where is the difference here? Is it in the raising? Is it in the animal?
It's everything. The genetics are very important. You can't take an animal that has been bred to eat grain only and then try to put them out in the field to eat grass. You have to have one of the older breeds, or you have to have developed new genetics, which are what is going on now, to get the kind of animal that will do well on grass. That's one. You need the right kind of grass, and depending on what part of the country you are, it's different. In some places, they sow special grasses and herbs for the animals, and others, they just have vast amounts of land, and so they can let them roam over the whole thing.
Right, right.
You have to know when to harvest the animals. You have to know that they should be humanely slaughtered, and you have to know how long to hang them. In other words, how to dry age them, and you must dry age them. That is essential. But all of those things are essential.
So this gets very complicated. It's not just a matter of once a calf is weaned, turn it out on the pasture, and X amount of months later, you've got an animal that's grass-fed and it's going to be great.
No, it's not, but it once was. I mean, I can't tell you that beef 100 years ago was as good as beef, grass-fed beef is today, but mm-hmm. I can tell you that when I was a kid, that's all there was grass-fed beef, and it was delicious. And if it was a little chewier than what the stuff that people don't have to have teeth to eat anymore is, so be it. But yeah. We didn't know any better. We didn't know that you have to have it to be like mush, and you don't. You wanted to have a little give, but you also wanted to have deep, rich flavor. And that's what I remember from my childhood. So all this stuff that we've gotten that's grain-fed since then, to me, when you get the grass-fed right, is that can't hold a candle to it.
Well, that's really encouraging. Okay, can you give us some of your picks?
I will give you my top three picks. And
okay.
I will tell you that this year for my annual online ordering column,
oh, yes, yeah.
I used tall grass beef. And you can find them at tallgrassbeef.com.
Okay.
A company called Laurel Ridge, which is in Litchfield, Connecticut, it also has very good beef, and that is LRGFB. That's probably more than people can remember, .com.
Well, we'll put it up on the website.
Okay. And U.S. Wellness Meats, which is uswellnessmeats.com. And finally, Whippoorwill Farms, also in Connecticut. Allen and Robin, A-L-L-E-N and Robin, R-O-B-I-N.com. Mm-hmm. They're much smaller, and I think that there's a possibility that they aren't always going to be consistent. But Laurel Ridge and Tallgrass and U.S. Wellness for sure.
This is going to be really interesting because I remember the flavor of beef.
Uh-huh. You two are old enough.
Yes. I hate to admit it, but it's true. And it's just not there anymore.
No.
There's also that other element that these animals were always meant to eat grass and not really born to eat grain originally.
No, they weren't. They're ruminants. That's why they have all those stomachs.
To process the grass as opposed
to
the grain.
Process the grass. And the more the animals can be on grass, the better.
Marion, thank you.
My pleasure.
Marion Burroughs is food columnist with the New York Times. Her article on grass-fed beef appeared in the August 30th, 2006 issue of the paper. Now, we've got Marion's tasting picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what world-renowned crop came to fame because of a fungus? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com
/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what world-renowned crop came to fame because of a fungus? Well, it's the tea of Ceylon. Now, this was one of those who knew stories. In the 1800s, Ceylon was under British rule, and it was one of the world's great producers of coffee. Some said the greatest producer. Now, I mean, when we think England and Ceylon, we think tea, right? No, it was coffee. Anyway, there were these British plantation owners who were making fortunes. A major British bank focused its investments on Ceylon coffee. And then a fungus hit, and it flourished. Scientists groped around for years to figure out what was going on, but by the 1890s, the coffee crop was wiped out. The British plantation owners were committing suicide, and that bank collapsed. Well, in desperation, some people turned to the island's minor crop, tea. And a man named Thomas Lipton bought up some coffee plantations and started growing tea for his British stores. Now, I am not going to say that old chestnut, the rest is history. But you have to know that the whole story and much more is told in botanist Nicholas Money's book, The Triumph of the Fungi, A Rotten History. It's time for your calls, brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Pick up that phone, guys. The number is 800-537-5252. Okay, we have got Doreen on the line. She got in touch with us at our discussion group at gather.com. Hey, Doreen, where are you calling from?
Downtown Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Right in the middle of downtown.
Absolutely.
So what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm preparing to adopt some a sibling set from an orphanage in Ukraine.
Really? How old are they?
Early teens. So they're old enough to remember their mother and their grandmother,
that
they no longer have, and family Christmas traditions. So I want to know if you can help me with knowing what kinds of dishes they would be looking forward to at Christmas time and where I can get the recipes.
I'm not that familiar with the Ukraine, but I am familiar with some books that you can go to. And there's two that come to mind, and both of these people are excellent researchers, so the material you're going to find in them will be dependable. One is Anja von Bremsen.
Anja von Bremsen?
Yeah, V-O-N, and then B-R-E-M... And I think it's Z-E-N. And Anya's a regular on the show. She writes about food and travel for Travel and Leisure in the New York Times and whatever. But Anya was born and raised in Moscow. And in the, I guess, more than 10 years ago, she did an incredible book on the foods of the Soviet Union. And it was called Please to the Table.
Okay.
And so that would be one I would check out. The other one is Dara Goldstein, and Dara did a book about winter food in this part of the world, and it's something like the winter vegetarian, something on that order, and it is mainly vegetables and grains, but that's wonderful food. You know, kids usually love, especially the grains and the dumplings and that kind of thing. So I think those are two people to go to. I wish I could just whip out, you know, specific dishes for you, but that part of the world is as complex as anywhere else, where there are no doubt specific traditions within the Ukraine and maybe even within the area they came from. But I think these two sources will be good places to start.
Yeah, that sounds good.
This sounds like it's going to be a wonderful time for you all, coming together, especially over the holidays.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I enjoyed talking with you.
You can call us at 800-537-5252. We've got Brian calling from York, South Carolina. Brian, what do you want to talk about?
I wanted to ask a question, which may actually curdle your blood as a chef.
Very little can curdle my blood at this point, but go for it.
I don't know. Most of the people I've suggested this idea to have reacted with pure horror. I am a big fan of Scotch eggs.
Now, remind me, it's the hard-cooked egg that's wrapped in sausage meat, and then it's fried.
Correct, yeah. You take a hard-boiled egg, wrap it in sausage, bread it, and then you deep-fry it.
That's right. Okay.
Fantastic. Oh.
I know. It's cholesterol heaven, but it's wonderful. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think if you eat three of them in a row, your heart will actually explode. and even more so guaranteed with this idea. I was wondering how feasible it would be to deep-fry my Scotch eggs in bacon grease.
Well, let's think for a minute. The first thing that comes to mind, you're already over the hill. Who cares if you're using pork fat to deep fry it? You know? And if it were good bacon fat, it would impart some luscious flavor. You've already got a lot of flavor coming out of the sausage. I think the only hesitation, I mean, again, I'm thinking you're over the top already. If you're trying to do, you know, low cholesterol or whatever, frying, forget it. It's gone. You know what the only thing I'd be hesitant about is the burn point of bacon fat. Different fats and oils start to break down at different frying temperatures.
Exactly. And that's exactly why I called, is because I don't want my house to catch on fire.
yeah. And it can flash. And, okay, here's the thing. I'm thinking lard and bacon fat are probably quite similar because they're fat of the pig. And lard's highest temperature would be around 350. And that's, I mean, you really want to fry those eggs between 350 and 375. So if I were you, I would think you'd want to use a non-hydrogenated, that would be like a cold-pressed or expeller-pressed vegetable oil.
Okay.
Just to be on the safe side because of the flash point.
Okay.
Now, if a little bacon fat went into that for flavor, I don't think you would have a problem.
Oh, that's true. I hadn't thought about mixing them both.
Yeah. I mean, not too much of the bacon fat, but you could have some for flavor. But again, you've got so much flavor going on in that sausage meat, you may not notice a big difference.
Okay.
By the way, one of the highest flash points, in some words, one of the oils that's really favored for frying because you can take it up pretty high, is, believe it or not, grapeseed oil. And it's pretty cheap in Europe. It gets pretty expensive here. But if you want to go for the primo, and it's pretty neutral in flavor, too, when you fry with it. But you can use most vegetable oils are going to do pretty well at around 375, which is the temperature you really want to fry at.
Okay.
Sounds
good. And, a buddy of mine has a turkey fryer. And so I figured if I actually decide to pull this off as an experiment, I'll do this, like, outside where, you know, if I go past the flash point, it won't be that big of a deal.
Yeah, and also, make sure you have a deep-fat frying thermometer stuck in there. Because
Absolutely.
If you add too many, you know, cold things, that oil's going to come way down. It's going to just seep in through the breading into the sausage, and then it's really – that gets pretty repulsive. Don't overfill is the key.
Will
here.
Do.
Okay. Hey, thanks.
Thanks so very much.
You take care. Bye, Brian.
Bye-bye.
Bacon fat, well, you know, it's good. It's really good. It's like duck fat and goose fat. And boy, if there's ever a season when if you feel like, you know, pan frying some potatoes, it's pretty good stuff. Anyway, call us, 800-537-5252. We have Craig calling from Des Moines. Craig, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I wanted to talk about lamb vindaloo, Lynn.
The Indian dish.
That's the one.
Oh, yeah.
I have been kind of experimenting with different recipes, using primarily my tongue to make the recipe.
Uh-huh,
And I can't get that kind of really heady, eye-watering, sweat-inducing spiciness. And that's what I really like about it. You know, I feel cleansed after I eat a good lamb vindaloo, and I want that sensation when I make it myself, and I'm not getting it. And I suspect it has something to do with my choice of peppers, and I'm not really quite sure what to use.
What are you using?
Well, I've tried what I know to be inappropriate peppers, such as jalapenos, but also chipotle peppers,
That would really be, because smoky peppers and are not going to, you know, it's just not traditional in that part of the world.
Exactly right. Yeah. And then I saw a recipe that called for chili powder, and even hot chili powder doesn't quite do it. And I suspect it has something to do with that kind of oily texture you get in a good lamb vindaloo, and that I'm wondering if there's a kind of pepper-infused oil I should be using or something
no.
like that.
You know what just occurred to me?
No. What?
Mustard oil.
Mustard oil. I don't think I've ever heard of mustard
well,
oil.
Well, you find it in Indian shops, and I'm remembering one of the first painstakingly authentic Indian cookbooks that came out over the past 30 years. You know, when the interest in quote-unquote authentic, I want it the way it is in its place of origin.
Right, right.
Was, I think it's called Classic Indian Cooking, but it's by Julie Sahni, S-A-H-N-I. And she's done several books since then. Anything by Julie is going to be just right on. And I made her vindaloo for quite a long time. And what I remember was that there was mustard oil in it. And mustard oil will clear your sinuses, and it can have heat. It is pretty potent stuff. And you'll find it in Indian groceries, and you can probably find it, you know, online.
Okay.
But because the chili choice would be things like cayenne, which can take the top of your head off.
Mm-hmm.
But they may not even be that hot. That sinus-clearing quality, if I'm hearing you correctly, it can come from two things. It can come from the heat of the chili,
mm-hmm.
and it can also come. Mustard oil has this quality.
Yeah, I think that's it, because it's not as if the food isn't hot enough. It's just not. It's not resonating in the right place.
Yeah, and I would say, get a hold of Classic Indian Cooking by Julie Sahni. I think, first of all, you'll never go wrong with her recipes.
Oh, great,
The two, I mean, there are so many good Indian cookbooks out there now by many authors, but, you know, this is one personally I use for a very long time, and so I can recommend it from firsthand experience.
Well, I'm so pleased to have an excuse to get another, you know, non-Anglo cookbook in my collection.
You know, what, and also look at anything by Madhur Jaffrey, Jaffrey. She's another person who will give you glorious stuff.
Terrific.
And she not only writes about India, which is her native country, but she writes much about the Southeast part of Asia. Oh, there's books out there, non-Anglo books you are going to have such a ball with.
I can't wait to look through them. And thanks for the oil tip, because it is really a question of a getting up in my head in the right place.
And the mustard oil does it. It's pretty potent stuff. It really is.
Okay, terrific.
Hey,
thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Mustard oil is really, it's something though, you want to get it in a place where there's a lot of turnover, or order it online where, you know, they specialize in Indian products, because I'm not sure what the shelf life is on it. Anyway, 800-537-5252. You know, in antiques, provenance is everything. I mean, if you can prove that an object came from a famous person, the price soars. Well, keep that in mind when you're thinking about what to give the wine geek. For instance, how about a corkscrew with a royal connection, complete with a royal seal? Well, we have Fred Cambuleves on the line. Now, Fred is the owner of Custom Curling. That is the importer of this corkscrew. Fred, welcome.
Good morning.
So what is this corkscrew about?
Well, it's a very special piece. It is made with the hawk tree of Marie Antoinette's hawk. This tree was a favorite tree to rest during hot summer days in Versailles Castle, actually near our little Trianon, next door to our little house. And this tree was already 100 years old when she was Queen of France. And actually, this tree was planted in 1679 by André Le Nôtre by order of Louis the 14th.
Uh-huh. So this is an oak tree that Marie Antoinette loved to sit under.
It was actually, as of 2003, it was still Marie Antoinette's oak. This is how it was called in France.
So we're talking about something that was over 300 years old. But
it
now,
is, yeah, when it died in 2003, it was 324 years old.
So how did it turn up in corkscrews?
How? Well,
yes.
The relationship that that Mr. Vaiallis, the creator of the Chateau Laguiole, has with the Chateau de Versailles started in 1999 when 1,300 trees died due to a storm in Versailles. And he purchased four beautiful trees, specimen trees also, from the when they fell in 1999. And this oak tree did not die because it was so huge that the storm didn't get it. Uh-huh. But it did actually broke a few branches, and the tree didn't feel good since 1999. It wasn't you know, in good health. And in 2003, it was a heat wave in Paris, and the tree finally died in 2003, and they uprooted the tree. And Mr. Vallès had a very good relationship with the people in Versailles, and he actually purchased the tree to to make openers and knives.
Now, Laol is famous for their knives and yes. for their corkscrews.
Yes.
So now, is this the handle of the corkscrew is actually from the oak?
Yeah,
of
this
Marie
is
Antoinette?
Exactly that oak tree, and then no one else, you know, can use that tree because he purchased the whole tree, believe it or not, all 115 feet long. And this wood that you actually see on those openers that we have is exactly that tree. It's 324-year-old oak tree, Marie Antoinette's oak.
Talk about a status symbol. How much is the corkscrew?
This one is $139.89. And he also has the seal of Marie Antoinette engraved in it. Marie Antoinette used to engrave or put her seal in everything she owned in the Petit Trianon, in her house near the castle. And for the first time, Versailles agreed to give the permission to use this seal. And we actually placed it on this opener. So the seal that you see on the opener is actually Marie Antoinette's seal. It's an interlock, A and M, and that's the original seal of Marie Antoinette.
Oh, I've seen the seal. This is pretty interesting. I mean, this would really be quite a singular gift. Hey,
yeah, for the person who has it all.
I love the idea. A piece of Marie Antoinette's life. Well, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I wish you happy holidays to you and all your listeners.
And to you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Fred Camboulives is owner of Custom Curling, the importer of Laol Marie Antoinette corkscrews. Now, Laol is, by the way, spelled L-A-G-U-I-O-L-E. I know you've seen it, and now you know how to pronounce it. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from the British wine writer Oberyn Waugh. He said, "A tremendous amount of unnecessary suffering goes on under the name of Leframilch." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today, solutions for life's little problems, and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletters. Weeknight Kitchen is our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek, and Baker's Chronicle will get you baking over the weekend. Now, you can also download our weekly podcast. Sign up for it online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is supported by the Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection, gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. You can learn more at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Alexis Donath. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Thanks for listening. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.